gals would come out tonight, come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gals would come out tonight, dance for the light of the moon.
You see, you make a wish, and then you try to break some glass. You got to be a pretty good shot nowadays, too, with so many windows already broken out.
Oh, no, George, don't. It's full of romance, that old place. I'd like to live in it.
In that old place?
Uh-huh.
I want to live in it as a ghost. Man. Now watch, right on the second floor.
Wait, let's get this.
Oh, nice.
Sunday morning nice. History.
Production value, baby.
Beautiful.
Sunday morning history was made here last week. With our special tree time broadcast that we did last week. Dave Schwann, Andy Mazur recreating a scene from It's a Wonderful Life. Schwanny, you especially must be so proud. You work your entire career in journalism, doing your best and doing a fine job of delivering, you know, thoughtful, important news.
And important news in light of all that we are dealing with, especially
this year. And all destroyed in one segment.
In a two-minute bit that we did.
Oh, man. All I heard about all week.
I left here.
That's all I heard about all week.
Last Sunday, and I said to myself, what's going to happen? And I got home, and I turned on the radio to see if we were still on the air.
Yeah, we were.
We were.
We survived.
So that's all you heard about all week then.
Got a lot of response to people who enjoyed the show last week.
Good.
Because we had a lot of fun. But also we had a lot of news last week. I mean, it was a balancing act last week because of the presidential results. So, you know, it was all this serious news and all of our tree time fun. Thank you to our friends at Tree Time for
it was almost like we were there
sponsoring it. Yeah, I think we did. I'm going to say we did an okay job of delivering a holiday spectacular without the usual surroundings.
Yeah, and we missed our live studio audience, our friends.
Yeah, that's true.
We always did. There.
Oh, can you imagine if you had done this in front of a studio audience out there? Wow,
they'd still be clapping.
Yeah,
right today.
Live radio at its best.
I've had people wanting you to recreate the Marilyn Monroe scene now from Diamond Star Forever. Cher from Moonstruck.
Jeez.
I've had people wanting both of you to do Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, cool.
Thelma and Louise, maybe.
That
could work.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
That could definitely work.
Schwanny's got a whole new career for himself as a result of that last week.
I debated about doing it. Then I thought, I told you. I said I could do a bad female impersonation up with some inflection.
At the beginning of the show, you said who should be George and who should be Mary. And I said, well, you know, why don't you guys decide? And I think you made the right choice.
Me too.
I'll never forget Andy falling off the chair in the sports studio.
All of us. All of us.
That first syllable.
I never saw him react that way.
That was good.
You kidding me? And I got to say, that recreation of It's a Wonderful Life, all the idea of Elton Jim Toronto.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I said, we're looking for some new things to do that we haven't done on the show before. And he texted me and said, why don't we do, this and that? And it was his idea, so.
Well,
and he was, he and I did a scene as George Bailey and Mr. Potter.
That was good, too.
Not even remotely as close to what you guys did. Got to give credit where credit's due.
No, that worked out well, though. You know, the two of you doing, you do a great Mr. Potter.
Well, you know, I
typecasting.
I do bring a little grumpiness and bitterness to it.
And you had to work in the line, Happy New Year.
Yeah, it wasn't even in the scene. It wasn't even in that one scene, but we added it anyway.
But you added it beautifully. Seamlessly, flawlessly.
Well, we had a nice time. We had a lot of fun. Number one, all the usual things, and lots of breaking news. So we had a good time, and I'm glad everyone seemed to enjoy listening to it. We've quite a bit of response to the show. Have you heard? Did you hear from management at all about that?
No. I didn't know.
No, did not. I was wondering.
Yeah, no. Well, actually, I did. I did hear from, and they enjoyed it greatly.
Good. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And they're thinking of doing a new Kathy and Judy show with Schwani as either, as either Kathy or Judy.
Maybe he's both.
Save a little money that way. Never know. Anyway, so we've got a fine show for you today, including I did a exclusive Chicago exclusive one-on-one with Matthew McConaughey this week. Really interesting conversation. We're going to share that a little later on in the program. We are getting very close to Thanksgiving, so we're going to chat with the Butterball Turkey Talk Line folks this morning, kind of get you ready for, I think it's going to be a modified Thanksgiving this year. I don't think people are going to be celebrating in their usual traditional way. I think everything's going to be a lot smaller, so we'll get into that later on. We've got a bunch of things that we're going to get in here into here today, including a visit with Dr. Kevin Most. And also Mighty Tasty is your weekly far-flung forecast. Fascinating compendium of fascinating facts presented to us each week by Thespian Galore. That would be a good show name for you, Schwani. When you get into burlesque. And now here she is on stage, Thespian Galore.
Ba-dum-bum.
Reminds me of a James Bond movie I used to know. And now, wait a minute. Let me introduce you first. Ladies and gentlemen, your host for this week's far-flung forecast, Dave Cheeks Schwan.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Dean, and good morning, everybody. Today, our far-flung forecast takes us to Delaware, Ohio. In the more or less in the middle of the state. And near the Columbus area of Ohio. Okay. It was founded in 1808. And finally, 1808, mm-hmm. and incorporated in 1816. Present population is a little over 34,000 people. But we bring up Delaware, Ohio, because it is the home and the birthplace of Rutherford B. Hayes.
Oh, no.
Now, Dean, ask me why we're bringing up Rutherford B. Hayes.
I was wondering if there was some way we could work in a mention of Rutherford B. Hayes on the show today.
Well, I knew that you were anticipating this.
Is it his birthday today?
No, it's not his birthday.
Anniversary?
It's not.
Bar mitzvah?
It is. You might say, relatively speaking, it is an anniversary because Rutherford B. Hayes was our 19th president.
Right.
He running for president in 1876 on the Republican ticket. But this election, I thought this would be interesting in light of all we're seeing during
our
current...
Please don't tell me they're still counting votes in that election.
Well, you know what? They were counting votes for a long time in this election of 1876. Hayes was the Republican nominee. A gentleman by the name of Samuel Tilden was the Democratic nominee and governor of New York State. But the election was really, really, really close. And on November 11th of 1876, 3 days after the election, it looked like Tilden was the winner. But there were a few states that were not decided yet. Among them?
They were hanging chads. Literally, they were hanging people named Chad.
And ironically, Florida was one of those states.
Are you kidding
me? In 1876.
Really?
No.
Florida.
This went on for the remainder of 1876, and in January of 1877, things still weren't decided. So, in order to resolve the matter, Congress and then President Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, who was not running for re-election, decided that they would form a bipartisan electoral commission. Hmm. They would be the ones to decide the electoral votes, the voting, and everything else. Uh-oh. One of the people that was appointed, by the way, was a judge, Supreme Court Justice David Davis, who was a close friend of Abraham Lincoln, and was stepping down from the court, but he declined to serve because he had been elected to the Senate in Illinois, so another person was named. Well, to speed up the story...
This is a very complicated election you're bringing up.
Even more complicated. I'm trying to keep it short here. This commission met in...
Was there a journalist named Phineas Blitzer who was reporting on it?
Might have been.
Did they have the magic board that they went through?
That's right.
And some guy in the back room going, Florida, Florida, Florida.
The magic was that they would put chalk on the board.
Uh-huh.
But in February, the compromise was reached. Hayes became president.
Wait,
and
who decided, though?
This commission was the one that finally decided who was going to run. They struck a deal.
They
How about that?
A deal.
Politicians striking a deal.
What happened to the vote? What happened? Did we have an electoral college then?
We did have an electoral college, but it was just they couldn't come up with a winner. So They couldn't come up with a winner. So this commission was the one that decided who indeed was going to be the Democrats. Now, one of the reasons
I'm very confused. I'm not questioning you. I know you're just reporting what happened. But either you count the votes or you don't count the votes, or you go to the... You have X number of people in the Electoral College, or you don't. How could they have not come up with a conclusion?
Apparently things were so close. And there were also, get this, also charges of voter fraud.
No.
Yes, there were charges of voter fraud.
That never happens.
But there were concessions made in exchange for things to be decided in the way in which the election would turn out. But through this commission, and as far as I know, this is the only time this type of thing happened to decide a president. Remember, 20 years ago, we had the Supreme Court decide, ultimately, that George W. Bush was going to be president. So things like this can happen. And Delaware, Ohio is the birthplace of Rutherford B. Hayes, our 19th president. They have reign in 52 there right now.
That's so interesting. I'm really perplexed by how they, did they ever finish counting the votes? I was joking when I said they didn't count the votes. There had to be a winner unless it was a tie.
It probably was some sort of a tie of sorts. Keep in mind also that, counting wasn't as quick as it is today or accurate, perhaps.
One, two, three.
Well, they confused each other when they said one, 1,000, two, 1,000.
Right, one Mississippi.
Yeah. But I thought it would be interesting to bring up an interesting election drama, as it were.
Yeah,
in
that is.
1876.
I never knew that about Rutherford B. Hayes.
I heard somebody talking about this a couple weeks ago, and I thought, maybe we can turn this into something.
That would be good for me to steal on the far-flung forecast.
So. So we
what is Rutherford B. Hayes best known for during his fake presidency?
Well, he was president.
His hoax presidency.
He was president in...
what years?
1877 to 1881. He served only one term. He was...
Did he put toilets in the White House famous? Bowling alley?
He served as governor of Ohio, but also was a staunch abolitionist, meaning, he was he served in the Civil War and probably knew or admired Abraham Lincoln. The Republican Party was relatively new at that time. The Whig Party and other parties were the forerunners of the Republican
Party. Excuse me, that's the Toupee Party?
Those must have been fun parties.
You leave your wigs. You leave your wigs at the door.
It's W-H-I-G.
Did they actually wear wigs? Did judges wear wigs back then?
I don't know about here, but they did in Great Britain.
Well, they still do in Great Britain.
They're wearing those big wigs.
Those Cher wigs. Those Cher and Dolly Parton wigs.
But he served one term. He was governor of Ohio, and that was it. So the president after him, James Garfield, only served less than a year. He was assassinated.
Well, I'm just
hello.
I'm
Are
just
you still there.
Well, I'm pausing here.
You still with me?
I'm just looking at some information about Rutherford B. Hayes to see.
Oh, okay.
To see if there's anything you know outstanding about his presidency that we can mention.
One of the things that he was involved with was ending the Reconstruction era for the Southern states. Mm-hmm. You know, this was just not long after the Civil War, that whole Reconstruction program. So there were still federal troops, northern troops in the southern states at that time. So he you know, saw an end to that as the nation was coming together and healing after the Civil War.
Here, I found a little tidbit, the kind of thing I was looking for.
You're going to end up writing a biography on Rutherford B. Hayes now, aren't you?
I just like little tidbits about some of these, you know, the people you hear about in the history. Rutherford B. Hayes and his wife were best known for keeping an alcohol-free White House.
Okay.
They did not serve booze in their...
They did not drink. They did not imbibe.
In their White House, Rutherford B. Hayes was dismayed at drunken behavior at receptions hosted by ambassadors around Washington. And he and his wife, Lucy, her name was Lucy, and her nickname was Lemonade Lucy because they didn't... They didn't serve alcohol in the White House. Alcohol was not served in the Hayes White House again.
That's why nobody came to state dinners.
Where's the booze? Hey, Lemonade Lucy, where's the booze?
Take mine to John Daly.
Dean Richards Sunday morning. Time for our weekly visit with Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern Central DuPage Hospital. Good Sunday morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, Dean. Beautiful day, huh?
Wow. It's as depressing as the COVID news that we've had the last few days.
Yeah, it really is.
It's actually gotten scary again. With the numbers rising, positivity rates are at a high, infection rates are at a high, hospitalization rates all over the country at record levels. Are you as disturbed as many of us lay people?
Yes, very concerned, actually. You know, and you hit all the high points right there, like this surge and this wave is doing nothing but getting bigger. And I can tell you that the hospitals right now are really being pushed. You know, if we look back 5 weeks ago, we were down to 8 patients with none in the ICU. Now we're at over 100 and like 15 or 17 in the ICU. So, and that's happened everywhere. That's all hospitals right now are being pushed to the brink. And one is certainly the bed situation, but more importantly is the staffing situations.
Staffing, supply levels, et cetera, about where we were in the spring? Or, I mean, has it changed during this length of time when we were at a previously high rate, similarly high rate?
Yeah, actually, the PPE, the equipment that we need, we're actually sitting pretty good. Many of us continue to try to get as much as we could while we saw the little dip there in August. So at least we have some surplus for the equipment. The difficult thing is the staffing. It's not like you can just go out and buy additional staff. And I'll tell you, this nursing staff and the respiratory therapists and the physicians have really been beat up. You know, we took spring break away from them. We pretty much took summer vacations away from them. And now we're asking them to work, you know, many, many more hours than they normally would.
So are we seeing the levels of severity different than we had before? Or is that similar to what we saw at the beginning of the pandemic?
No. The nice thing is it's certainly the severity is a little less. As we talked in the past, this strain that came through in, you know, June, July, seems to be much more contagious, but much less severe. And we couple that with, we have a few months now of information, right? We know remdesivir works. We know dexamethasone works. We know to intubate patients as quickly and actually put them on their stomach with high flow oxygen. We have antibody testing, and we have antibody therapies now. So we have learned a lot. It's like changing the cars on a moving, changing the wheels on a moving car. But we are absolutely doing much better from a treatment point of view.
Yet, you know, government officials on all levels, all states, and interestingly, all parties now are, you know, suggesting stay-at-home orders and more. You know, essential services and businesses that were open before may not be this time. Schools may be closing again. Do you think all of that is in order?
Yeah. You know, it's unfortunate. We had the perfect storm with the election where we, I don't want to say we took our eye off the ball because many of us did not, but I think the general public may have taken their eye off the ball and focused on something else. And we kind of lost 2 weeks there and maybe even a week after the election. So with that period of time where the focus wasn't on COVID, certainly now we are going to ramp up well beyond where we may need to have been. But certainly we are going to have to look at more, I don't want to say constrictions, but we're certainly going to have to be smarter. You know, grocery stores, I think we all got a little lax. And not that there's been a lot of transmission in grocery stores, but even in restaurants, I think we got a little lax. And right now, we have no ability or we have no cushion to relax right now.
I know when I was going to grocery stores in the spring and at the beginning of the pandemic, I'd put gloves on. I would spray down my shopping cart before I would touch anything, even though I had the gloves on and, of course, a mask. And I was super diligent about wiping the groceries down when I came home. And now you can't even find the spray cleaner in a lot of the stores to wipe the carts down that somebody had just touched or sneezed on or who knows what before you got it. Is that what you're talking about of the state of being lax?
Yeah, a little fatigue there where we're not as diligent as we were before in protecting ourselves as well as protecting others. And probably one of the biggest things is masking and wearing a mask appropriately, because we know that's the major transmission of this virus. So I'm just afraid that with the cold weather and restaurants being shut down, people are going to gather in their homes more frequently now. And I think we just have a laxity in our homes as well. Nobody wants to invite over six friends and then wear masks in a room. And yet that's going to be one of the points that we're going to see that will be spreading this illness more.
Yeah, which brings us to Thanksgiving, which is right around the corner. I'm shocked at the number of people that I've talked to who have said it's going to be Thanksgiving as usual for them, that this has been such a hard year. Don't take away my Thanksgiving. We're all getting together as we always have. And that, from what all the experts are saying and from what science is saying, is a mistake.
Dean, it blows me away when I hear that. You know, if you look around your Thanksgiving table, go back for the last 5-10 years and look around who was at your table, how many of them would be deemed to be called vulnerable? How big is your table? And then all it is, it comes down to simple math. You know, we talk about Thanksgiving is the one time I know it, at least at our house, we would sit at the table for an hour.
Right.
You know, because it's a chance to talk to people maybe that you haven't seen for a little while. You know, that's the biggest concern right now is what are we going to see in early December, essentially 2 weeks after Thanksgiving, where vulnerable people may have been exposed. You have college kids coming home. You have kids running around. No one's going to be wearing a mask, unfortunately, in most cases. And you're going to stay in a very close proximity for an extended period of time, which when you have a 15%, 20% positivity rate, chances are someone at Thanksgiving, if you have 10 people there, chances are you're going to have two or three people that are asymptomatic positive.
Yeah, you have to ask yourself, you know, is the tradition of getting together for Thanksgiving worth it? For a couple of people out of that 10 who might test positive, some people who may have pre-existing conditions to the point where it becomes extremely severe. Is it worth it for the tradition of the sit down and, you know, listening to Uncle Jimmy's, funny stories that he tells every year around the table?
Go ahead. Yeah, I've said it for what, maybe a month or 2 months now. You know, we canceled ours. I certainly don't. It would be the worst Thanksgiving ever if my mom or my sister or someone got COVID at that setting. And it would make future Thanksgivings not as thankful, I'll
say. Absolutely, absolutely. You don't want that hanging over your Thanksgivings. 9:50 is the time. Dean Richards, Sunday morning with Dr. Kevin Most from Central DuPage Hospital on the line with us. A couple of showbiz stories, Doc. There is a R&B singer, rapper by the name of Jeremiah. He's a Chicago-born and raised singer. Went to Morgan Park High School, went to Columbia College. He's had a number of hits. Was admitted to a Chicago hospital with COVID-19, was put on a ventilator, and news reports saying that he's not doing well. He's 33 years old. That seems unusual for somebody only 33 years old, or am I wrong?
No, very. So without knowing if he had any underlying, you know, other medical conditions like, you know, diabetes, heart disease, asthma, you usually will see those healthy, 15 to 35-year-olds do fairly well with this illness. But this is just a reminder that for people in that age group, that everyone doesn't do well with this illness, and that, you know, the virus has different impact on different individuals.
What struck me with this is generally people who are testing positive his age get over it fairly quickly. You know, they have their symptoms, they get over it in a few weeks. You hardly ever hear them being put on ventilators. And the reports are that he's not doing well. I hope that changes. But that's going on right now. Here's the medical showbiz medical story that has me perplexed. There is a very popular singer by the name of Erykah Badu, who was going to do a viral concert with her band. So they all go in to get tested. She gets her test results back, and she is COVID-19 positive in one nostril and COVID-19 negative in the other nostril. I've never heard of anything like that.
Well, you have to remember that both nostrils at the end in the back of our throat end up in the same place, so that they're not two totally separate pipes. They actually converge in the back of our throat, in the back of our nose, which is where we actually find the virus. That's why those narrow nasal pharyngeal swabs were going all the way back. So whoever collected it, you collected it from one side, you collected it from the other side. If they were doing just the nasal swab, it's one of the reasons that we're doing this, because we know that the virus lives much, much further back. But certainly now we have testing capabilities to just do a simple nasal swab instead of the one that goes in well into the back and is very uncomfortable.
So is that to say that they did not go back far enough with their swab in order to, you know, get to a common area, that they only tested the more shallow part of each individual nostril?
Well, you have to remember, right now we have more opportunities to test, right? We have saliva tests, right? So people are just spitting in a tube, so they're not even going into the nasopharyngeal. We have nasal tests where we're just going into the nose, very comfortable, very easy to do. And then the nasopharyngeal, which was obviously the gold standard in the past, where we went all the way back. So it really depends on what test she had done and whether, you know, the swab was good to, at the time of collection. But these are the ones, the nasal swabs are the ones right now that you're going to see that we're going to be using, having people do at home. So they'll swab themselves and send it in. You've probably seen it already in some of the drive-thrus where the people swab themselves. An individual could not do a nasopharyngeal swab themselves because, one, they wouldn't tolerate it, and, two, there's a technique that needs to be taught. So this one may have just been a simple nasal swab, and the viral load on one side was bigger than the viral load on the other.
Interesting. From the 847 area code regarding, people going out for Thanksgiving dinner, thinking, it won't be safe to do it inside somebody's house. Let's go out for dinner. The text says, I'd like to know the doctor's viewpoint on restaurants outside seating versus inside a tent. How is sitting inside a restaurant having dinner any more dangerous than sitting outside a restaurant in a completely sealed off tent?
Exactly. Hopefully this listener has been listening the last couple of weeks because we've had this exact discussion. Especially think of days like today. If you're going to eat outside today, wherever you're going, they're going to have the sides down and you have no air circulation in those. We've all been in tents at weddings in the summer where there's no air circulation. So this is one where I think we kind of missed the ball here a little bit, that we really should have been focusing on the summer on air circulation in restaurants, negative airflow, in other words, having all the air flow out of the restaurant instead of circulating, things that may have made it safer to eat indoors. I would not be, as the weather starts to get colder and these enclosed areas get to be a little more stagnant and they can't have the sides up where there's good air circulation, I'd be very hesitant to be eating there.
What about a restaurant that has a tent? Or I guess it would also apply to indoors, but they have some sort of ventilation system, some kind of fan, something to keep the air circulating inside. Does that make it safer?
Absolutely. So you know, you've probably seen these globes that they have that they've been putting up with a lot of places in Chicago. All of them have a great fan system in them as well. So it's probably moving more air out again. We want to move the air out and bring more fresh air in. So hopefully a lot of these have been designed for that. It's exactly what we do in the hospital with these patients. We put them in a room where the air flows out of the building, so it doesn't come back into the hospital. So if you're a COVID patient and you're in the hospital, you're in a negative airflow room. Everything flows outdoors, dilutes in the environment, and then really it makes it much safer for everybody caring. Same concept should be thinking about in restaurants.
630 area code, are restaurants safer than schools?
It's a great question. And, you know, if we look at schools and we do schools the right way, these kids are physically distanced. They're wearing masks. They often have barriers up. And as long as they're behaving, they probably are more safer than restaurants where we're taking the mask off. We're sitting, you know, 5 feet, 4 feet away from each other, talking for a long period of time. If you look at a lot of the school settings, those kids are at their desk with barriers up, with the mask on the entire time. And schools probably are safer than restaurants right now.
All right. We'll leave it there. Dr. Kevin Most, Chief Medical Officer, Northwestern's Central DuPage Hospital. Have a great Sunday, Kev. Thanks for joining us.
You got it, Dean. Take care.
That's hard rock and cocoa. Chicago holiday traditions, including Hard Rock Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, Frosty the Snowman, all part of our annual airing of Bozo, Gar, and Ray, WGN-TV Classic. Schwanee, it's back.
What memories. Every time I hear this, I just think back to coming home from Lincoln School.
Yep.
And watching this, or you know, being out with my friends messing around before dinner, and
that's right,
going over to someone's house for some hot chocolate.
Yep, yep.
Watching this. Yep.
It's our 15th year, believe
it
or
really?
Not. 15th year since we've produced the show, and people look forward to it now. Holiday time and Thanksgiving morning, Bozo, Gar, and Ray will be on WGN television. Bozo, Gar, and Ray, WGN TV Classics. Followed by our two-hour special, Bozo Circus, the 1960s. Did a follow-up special that will be on from 10 until noon on Thanksgiving morning. Normally, all of this happens after the Thanksgiving parade, but there is no Thanksgiving parade this year. thank you, pandemic. No parade this year. So immediately following the WGN morning news at 8 a.m., Bozo, Gar, and Ray, WGN-TV Classics, and then from 10 until noon, Bozo Circus, the 1960s. Bring back a lot of wonderful memories from Bozo Circus, from the Garfield Goose and Friends, from Ray Rayner, all these great shows that you grew up with on WGN television. So we're very much looking forward to that. I want to talk about some other great Chicago holiday traditions.
Yeah! In jail. Going home, they there waiting for you.
God, I love that. I cannot even tell you how much I love that scene. From the movie It's a Wonderful Life.
Go on home. They're waiting for you.
Happy New Year to you in jail.
For 19 years, American Blues Theater has presented its production of It's a Wonderful Life live in Chicago. It's this wonderful version that we have featured year after year, but it's being different, going to be done differently this year, as are most things. And joining us on the phone line to explain it all is the artistic director of American Blues Theater, Wendy Whiteside, my friend. Hello there. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm good. Thank you so much, Dean, for having us on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. My only regret is that you're all not here in studio with us, as you always are, to do some scenes. But yeah. Explain how this is going to be done this year virtually.
Sure. So we knew it would be anachronistic to try to have everyone step back in time to 1940s while they're on their computer. And, you know, emailing us and asking us, you know, we're having volume problems or technical problems. So we decided to do it on Zoom live. So all of the actors are in their own homes and cool. They're doing the story. And we're setting it in 2020. And then when we actually do the telling of the story, then we tell everyone to suspend their disbelief and go back in time with us. But it was... Yeah, there were a lot of really cool challenges this year that we had to figure out is, A, how to keep everyone healthy and safe, audience, as well as our creative team. So we created sets and put them all in big plastic tubs and gave them training videos of how to build a set in their own home. Oh, wow. And gave them costumes and props. And, it was pretty fun.
That's that sounds like that's going to be great. And that's going to be running... let me see here.
It's running now until January 2nd.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah.
So how can people access it?
They can go to our website, AmericanBluesTheater.com, and they can buy tickets, and then we will make sure that they get the Zoom link and all the pertinent information they need for their computers.
Great. Great. And I know that John Moreland is back as Clarence and Mr. Potter.
Yes.
And Brandon Dahlquist is back as George Bailey.
That's right.
Audrey Billings as Mary Bailey. And our pal Mike Mahler doing the music for the show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, very much the same kind of production that you've gotten to know through the years. Wendy, I don't know if you heard that we did some readings from It's a Wonderful Life last week here on the show. We did a kind of a pre-holiday special last week. And
are you coming for my job? I don't have much in life. Come on, give me something.
Well, wait till you hear what we did before you think that we are in any way threatening.
So
we just did a couple of quick scenes. Elton Jim Toronto and I did George Bailey and Mr. Potter, and that we'll just play a little bit of that now. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do for you, George. Since the state examiner is here, and as a stockholder of the building and loan, I'm going to swear out a warrant for your arrest. Misappropriations of funds, manipulation, malfeasance.
No, Mr. Potter.
All right, George, go ahead. You can't hide in a little town like this. Merry Christmas, George, and Happy New Year. In jail. Now, I know that wasn't part of the scene. I just wanted to throw that in. But
oh, my gosh, that was awesome.
Here was the showstopper. Here was the showstopper. The Lasso the Moon scene where Mary and George are walking down the street playing George Bailey, our sportscaster, and Andy Mazur, who is here right now. Andy, this is Wendy.
Nice to meet you, Wendy.
Hi.
And
hi.
playing Mary Bailey. We went back to the Shakespearean era, having our newscaster Dave Schwann playing Mary. Here's what that sounded like.
Oh my God.
You see, you make a wish, and then you try to break some glass. You got to be a pretty good shot nowadays, too, with so many windows already broken out.
Oh, no, George. Don't. It's full of romance, that old place. I'd like to live in it.
In that old place?
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't live in it as a ghost. Now watch, right on the second floor there.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Production value, baby.
Beautiful.
See, we had our sound effects also, Wendy.
Oh, my gosh. That is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
Wendy, yes, it's fake. It was rigged. It was rigged, Wendy.
It was rigged. It was a hoax scene.
You have made my morning. That is brilliant.
So if Audrey, you know, goes sick at any point during this and you need someone to step in and play Mary, Shawnee is available.
We'll take him. That's fantastic.
You can have him.
You can have him. Thanks. Thanks.
Give our love to everybody, Wendy. It's nice to talk to you again.
You too. Thank you.
You can see a real version of It's a Wonderful Life live in Chicago online. What's the website again, Wendy?
Sure. AmericanBluesTheater.com.
Sounds great. And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you for joining us. 10:22, Dean Richards Sunday morning on WGN. We told you about It's a Wonderful Life that will be performed virtually on our theater segment this week. We also wanted to make you aware of something else that's going to be going on theater-wise, virtual-wise. And for that, we are joined by Techie Lomanicki, who is the artistic director of Tellin' Tales Theater, that will be doing virtual 1920s radio. Techie, very nice to have you with us. Welcome to WGN.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So explain what this virtual 1920s radio show that you're doing.
Okay, well, what it is, it's our show, Six Stories Up in the Roaring Twenties. And this is our 23rd Six Stories Up. We get six middle school kids and six adult mentors together, and we write an original show on a theme. Well, this year, we were thinking, oh, gosh, what are we going to do? We can't do it in a theater. You know, then we put it all together. And one of our ensemble members had this idea, ooh, make it a radio show.
Yeah.
And the reason we wanted to do it in the 20s is that we saw so many similarities between the 1920s and 2020. It's so cool. I mean, like the racial issues going on, immigration issues were going on then, women's rights, the silver screen and how women were treated there.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, prohibition, you know, which we had with a little bit with some marijuana. So what we did is we wrote it. Each team wrote one of the scenes, like took prohibition or, you know, women's rights.
Yeah.
And so the way we did it is that everybody got a background for their and a physical background for their homes. So it looked like we were in a radio studio. We had our set designer made these lollipop kind of microphones, old-fashioned 1920s.
Sure, yeah.
Microphones. It's so gorgeous. It's just hilarious.
That's when a microphone was a microphone back then.
Yeah, it really, really was. And we had wonderful 1920s costumes that just transformed, you know, everybody back into the 20s. And what the concept is a boy, Jack, is complaining about the pandemic. He's 13. He's complaining. His mother finally said, oh, I can't take it anymore. I'm taking you to the Volo Car Museum. Antique car museum.
Yeah.
So he hops in an old car, which we actually went there and filmed this section.
Oh, wow.
The ghost of Dorothy Parker appears next to him in the seat, the writer, Dorothy Parker. And she takes him back to the 1920s in a radio show.
Wow, that sounds fun. That sounds really fun. The other part of this that I think is really interesting is that you had mentioned that you pair up children with adult mentors, but these are all people who are part of your program, who people who are living with cerebral palsy or autism, a variety of conditions. So it's also a fantastic exercise for both the adults and the kids.
Yeah, and actually some of the mentors also have disabilities, and some of the kids do and some don't. You know, we believe in mixing the two.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead. We have a weird delay on our phones that causes that. Please go right ahead.
It's a really great learning experience for both.
Okay, so how can people avail themselves of this and take a listen or take a look?
Yeah, it's a look. They can take a look because it's on Vimeo. 16th Street Theater in Berwyn is hosting us on Vimeo. However, they can get tickets on our website, TellinTales.org.
Okay, is that TellinTales? Tales?
Yes.
Okay, so TellinTales.org, right?
Correct.
All right, very good. I should also mention that all of this available with closed captioning available as well. So, you know, if people have hearing issues or whatever, they still will be able to take advantage of it. I think it's a really nice program that are helping both adults and kids, and just a fun way to entertain yourself. So congratulations on another great project. How many years, you said, you've been doing this?
This project, 23 years.
How about that? So you must be doing something right over there, huh?
I guess. I've been enjoying every one of them.
Good for you. Good for you for organizing and putting it all together. Teki Lominicki is the artistic director, Tellin' Tales Theater, and their six stories up in the Roaring Twenties. I hope you have a great Sunday today. Teki, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You too.
Right, all right, all right.
Those are the words best known for our next guest on the show today. It's been my honor to sit and talk with Matthew McConaughey for many, many, many years now. Not as far back as Dazed and Confused, but for some of his subsequent movies, Angels in the Outfield and the Newton Boys and U571. I think I talked to him for all of the romantic comedies that he did through the years. The Wedding Planner and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days and Failure to Launch and Fool's Gold, so many more, and The Lincoln Lawyer. He was in Magic Mike. He was in The Wolf of Wall Street, in Killer Joe, and won an Academy Award for his role in Dallas Buyers Club. Matthew McConaughey has, I guess you might call, an autobiography that's out right now that's called Green Lights, which talks about both personal and professional things that have happened in his life. I was very, very, very happy that we were able to sit down for this Chicago exclusive interview with Matthew McConaughey. The many times that we've sat down to talk, I'm always taken back to the one time that you were here in Chicago. You know exactly what I'm going to say, don't you?
I know exactly. You haven't had an interview in that office before.
I have, and have never since either. Out in the middle of a snowstorm, sitting out in Grant Park, you were touring the country, and it remains one of the most memorable interviews that I've ever done in my life.
Well, that was a grand experiment. My buddy and I pulled the Airstream around America. We put over 13,000 miles under us. And I remember, yeah, when we got up in the Northeast, when we got in there around Chicago, it was snow, it was cold. But it was a fun adventure. I haven't done a press junket like that yet either.
Yeah, it was fun. I just remember you and I like two idiots sitting out in the cold and the snow, trying to pretend like nothing was going on.
I figured, the weather, doing the interviews like that, it just kind of inevitably cuts the pretense out of everything because the elements are tough. You're like, okay, let's get down to it.
Well, I mean, you do a million of these interviews. I do a million of these interviews. To have, something that both of us remember so vividly, mission accomplished is all I can say on your part. Man, mission accomplished on this book of just a thoughtful and interesting guidebook on what you've been through in your life, Green Lights. Explain what the concept was and how you decided to do this.
Well, so I've been keeping a journal/diaries for 36 years. So I've got thousands of pages, hundreds of different journals that I've been collecting and putting Ziploc bags and put them in this treasure chest. And about 15 years ago, started threatening to go away and see if there were things in those journals that were worthy of putting into a book. And I didn't have the courage to do it. I finally got the courage about 2.5 years ago, and I went away. And I remember when I first sat down, I took them all away to this little shed in the desert just so I would be stuck with nothing but me and myself in the last 50 years, AKA my journals. And I had an idea of what I thought they were going to be. And I actually thought they were going to be very academic. And as I got into it, I started going, this is actually a little more poetic than academic. And all of a sudden I remember going, stop, let's just see what they are. Let them reveal themselves. And what came out of it, this, I ended up with 7 stacks in front of me. They were stories, people, places, prescribes, poems, prayers, and a whole lot of bumper stickers. And those were the 7 stacks. And then I said, okay, well, let's get into that and see if the central theme comes out. And the central theme that came out was the green light theme. I noticed that I caught green lights in my life, meaning things that are more freedom, being kind to our future self, delayed gratification, what have you. I caught a lot of those by decisions I had made. So I designed them by decisions and responsibilities I took for myself. I had some green lights that just fell in my lap. And I was like, whoa, I just got lucky. Where'd this come from? Thank you. And then I had quite a few that were all about perspective. Meaning I would hit a bump in the road and maybe not even give the crisis credit, AKA the yellow light, not even give it credit, just blow right through it, that hardship, and say, I'm not even going to give that crisis credit. I'm going to make it a green light. And then I also ultimately found, this was the real lesson in it, that the red and yellow lights in my life, the hardships, the pauses, the things that made me stop, the things I didn't want at the time, turned out to be things that I needed because there were lessons that I needed to learn that were inherent in them that I either realized at the time, the next day, the next week, 10 years later, and some I still haven't even realized yet, but believe that they will eventually reveal their green light assets via lessons learned in some time in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a great learning experience, really, that we all face green lights and red lights and yellow lights and, all of these great metaphors that are the sum total of our lives that hopefully we learn from, that red lights do turn into green lights and...
The fact that if they were all green, if life was all green lights, it wouldn't be about anything. It'd be about nothing more than entertainment. And so that, those yellows where we're forced to pause or be introspective or reapproach a situation, those serve us many times. We don't like them. But I think the sooner we can sit there and look and go, okay, I may not like this situation. This may be a hardship. This may be a crisis. But let me, without denying the crisis, how can I opine and kind of figure out what's the value in this for me? And there's usually something to find.
I always find it so interesting when somebody writes a book about their life or their experiences that they put all the warts and all out there. They put it all out there. Is that difficult to do? I mean, to tell difficult and painful things that happened in your life?
It wasn't really difficult. I tell you what would be difficult and what I haven't done is I would never do it, say, in this format or on a talk show or in a long form interview or in a periodical, because what was, I didn't, there's a lot of things that I know exactly what I mean to say. And I wanted to make sure that if it's by my hand, I can give context to the situation. It's in my words. There's a lot of things I wouldn't want to share and hadn't shared before and probably won't share in the future that I'm like, I'm not going to give that to someone else to let them put their spin on that. I don't want to, you know, what it's too many times, you know, that the headline. It's why, for instance, I didn't bring up and go into details about molestation earlier on in my life or being blackmailed into having sex. I'm like, you know what? There was nothing constructive there. If I explain that, someone's going to make that the headline of the book. And that's not what it's about. And that would be derailing people from the theme of the book. So it wasn't hard, actually. It was quite freeing to say, ah, and that's exactly how I mean to say it and how it went down. So therefore, it's in my words. I can't be misquoted. You can't, you know, you can't grab a sentence out of there, but it's a book. So people, if you read the thing, you get the context of each story.
Yeah, there was, it's very interesting because, you know, until I got my copy of the book, all I had heard were some of the flashy headlines that were being right. revealed. And then I read about an interview, I think it was in Australia or somebody or someplace in a non-American country that asked you about politics. And you, the way that you answered the question was that you would only do it in a long form way. So nothing was, could be taken out of context right. and become the headline that right. you wanted everything put in context was such a brilliant way of framing it. And then as I went through the book myself, I could see exactly what you were doing with all that.
Yeah. I mean, I've become aware, you know, over doing this for what, 30 something years of what the format is. There's a different tone. There's a different subject matter, different energy I'll take to a talk show that's going to be a 5-minute piece than I'm going to take to an hour and a half podcast or I try to get Q&As for everything that's written in a periodical. Like, oh, can I have the question and the answer? Because I mean what I'm saying, but boy, sometimes someone doesn't get it. I'll read it. I go, oh no, that isn't what I meant, or they paraphrase right, or something. Right. And so I'm aware of that, and I know, you know, especially the question like that. I think it was I forget who it was that asked me about politics, and they had asked me about Trump, and I was like, no, not right here. I get that. What if I say one thing? You now, especially in election year, is the time where you go, bam, you know. McConaughey feels this, and I'm like, no, it's not. It's not enough context. It's not the right format. They're not a platform.
Yeah, best response yet that I've heard to pesky questions that we ask about stuff like that. I would like high five you if you responded to me about a question like that, because that was a brilliant response in my book. You know, you do explain a lot, and your life experiences, and your highs and your lows. And you talk about your family and your kids. I wonder, like, what kind of advice would you give your kids? Would you want them to have as many green lights as possible, or mm-hmm. would you also want them to experience red lights so they appreciate the green lights when they Absolutely. Finally come?
Gotta have the shadows to appreciate the light. Have to. As I was saying earlier, if it's off, life's all green lights. If life is one big yes. You're just going to run in circles and get dizzy and burn out. You know, if life's nothing but candy, well, your teeth are going to rot out pretty quickly. And you're going to look up and go, wow, this was short money. Also, you know, there's different kinds. We have to watch what kind of green lights we get. Many of them are fads. They're lust. They're an immediate gratification, but they're only battery powered. They're not going to beam green for eternally. So I'm trying to teach our children, look, seek the eternal, infinitely glowing green lights in life, the things that will pay you back, not just now, but will pay you back through the rest of your life on your deathbed. And they will keep shining after you're gone. What are those green lights? Long money. You know, so you have to have the reds and the yellows and realize that, you know, and look, my kids are growing up in an affluent household. We were one of the haves, you know, and so Camille and I continually try to watch with our children. Okay, we don't want to deny that. We want to help them have be abreast of the affluence that we have, but to respect it, meaning there's a great lesson I taught them when after I won the best actor for Dallas Buyers Club. They're like, "What's the trophy for?" And I said, "Well, you remember a year and a half ago when Dad was, you know, you'd wake up every morning, Dad was gone. He'd get home at night. You look at him. He said, 'I look like a giraffe. I was so skinny.' Like, yeah, I remember that." I go, "Well, the work I was doing every day there, a year and a half later, my peers gave me a trophy and said, 'This is, you did excellent.'" And they got the first time they ever clicked on delayed gratification, that your future is a compounding asset. And what you do today is building towards those assets, good or bad. And so that's what, you know, we try and get them to understand that things are supposed to be hard. And some good, and a lot of things worth having are very hard and should be. And those can come in the form of yellow and red lights.
I love what a thoughtful, dedicated dad you are, you know, especially from the guy that we knew as the bongo playing wild child from.
I still play those bongos.
Hopefully a little more clothed than you did back in the day, right?
Hopefully not, but yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I had read that you wish you could have 8 more kids. Your wife doesn't agree with you on this, but you love being a dad, don't you?
I do. As I say in the book, it's the only thing I ever knew I wanted to be in life. And I remember it was 8 years old and I was meeting some of my dad's friends, and he was a big sirs and ma'ams, please and thank you, man. So, you know, you shake a man's hand, you look him in the eye. "Nice to meet you, sir. Nice to meet you, sir. Nice to meet you, sir." And I remember in my 8-year-old mind going, "Oh, you know what the common denominator about all these men that I'm having to call sir? The common denominator is that they're all dads." And in my mind, I was like, "Oh, that's when you've made it. That's when you've succeeded in life." And I had great reverence for fatherhood and still do. And as you know, are you a father?
I'm not.
You're not. Well, as you, when you, if you know, when I became a father, it was like, "Oh, okay. Well, just helping make the child is not being a father. You may biologically have been a father, but now the fatherhood is the verb. Now the work comes." You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. That's why I value so much my nieces and nephews, because they they're sort of my kids, and you know, I can help them with some of those things along the way. What are you doing during the quarantine? How are you getting by with
relatively all that? We're doing well. We're here in Austin, Texas. My children are remote schooling. My 88-year-old mother is with us. She's been with us for 7 months. So sometimes we have 4 kids in the house counting her. For the most part, you know, she's getting, so, you know, talk about what are the green light assets of a quarantine. For us, my mother is getting to see her grandkids every single day, which without the quarantine, she'd see them once every 2 weeks. There's value in that. Well, the kids will remember this. Mom's going to remember this. We're sitting down, you know, have a lot more home-cooked meals where we sit down, we make the food, and we sit down and say our gratitudes and have meals together and talk about our day. My kids are doubling down on some of their creative hobbies that I don't think they would have taken the time to do if life was going on as it was. Some people have noticed if I really have to start fighting even boredom. You know it from the book. I'm very comfortable in solitude. I don't have any itch to get off the property. I'm like, "Oh, this is great right here." And I'm in a position where the pantry's full. You know, there's a lot of this interaction remote that I prefer now. There are quite a few interactions where I'm like, "Oh, I'd rather be there in person. Oh, I want to give that person a hug. Oh, I want to high five that person." Oh, you know, but some of this, I'm like, it's just how much of this is going to be the new normal, even if we all get to a time where we feel like it's completely safe to go reengage.
Yeah, that's how I felt like in the beginning of doing all of this, these Zoom interviews and interacting with people virtually seemed so weird. And I recently just did an interview with Slash, you know, from Guns N' Roses. Yes. He happened to be in Chicago and I interviewed him one-on-one. And I said to him, "You're the first actual person that I've stood in front of and interviewed in 6 months. This is really weird. It was really weird. the body language and looking at his body language and seeing everything like I've done for 30 years.
Yeah.
That you don't always see in these Zoom interviews. So it really has become the new normal, I think, on both of our ends.
In a way, it'll be nice to be free to roam again. But you know, I'm not driving as much. I'm here at the house. So when I go out for a drive, I've got to actually check myself. I'm going, wait a minute, are you driving okay? You haven't done this in a while, and it's a bit surreal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, just my final question, I guess, for you. Do you want to punch somebody when they say, all right, all right, all right, to you? If you hear that one more time, are you going to scream?
No, I'm not. I actually, look, those are the first three words I ever said in film. In a summer in 1992 on the film Dazed and Confused, when my first night on a set, first night acting in a scene that we improvised, that I didn't know at that time if that was going to be the one night I worked in this little hobby, this little fun night I had in 92 and never acted again. And it turned out to be 28 years later, a career for me. So when I hear it, that's a call back to my inception of when I started doing what I've grown to love to do. Act and tell stories. So when someone says it, they may not know it, but I'm like, yep, that's the beginning. That is actually the beginning for me. So I take it as I have a little bit of honor in it.
Sure puts a smile on my face every time that I hear it. And every time that, you know, I see you say it when you won your Oscar, you know, when it just doesn't seem like it would come up and you inject it. It's like, all right, there you are. All right, all right, all right. There's Matthew. There's my pal.
Well, you know, and if someone says it, they're usually in a pretty good mood. They're usually about to offer something that you want or you know, it's an affirmative. You can use it. If someone's saying that coming into a situation, you have better chances of that being a situation you want to be in.
Yeah, that's true. But nobody says it like you. Nobody does it like you. Hey, congratulations on the book. I really, really, really enjoyed it. It's great to see you. All the best to you and the family. And one of these days, face to face again, I hope.
We'll see you on the other side in a snowy park.
Okay. I'll bring the lawn chairs.
Turkey for you. Let's eat the turkey in my big brown shoe. Love to eat the turkey at the table. I once saw a movie with Betty Grable.
The genius of Adam Sandler and the turkey song to herald in our annual chat with the Butterball Turkey Talk Line to answer your questions about Thanksgiving dinner preparation. We're going to be doing it this week and next week because we have two shorter shows and everything is different this year because of the pandemic. Pleasure to welcome Bill Nolan, who is a supervisor at the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. Bill, happy holidays to you, my friend. Nice to have you back with us.
Happy holidays, Dean. It's good to be back with you as well.
So how are things different at the Butterball Turkey Talk Line this year? Everything in the world is different this year.
Boy, it sure is. You know, everything is different like every place else. You know, the Talk Line this year, the first thing that's different is we've gone remote. So all of our Turkey Talk Line experts are working remotely from their home kitchens.
Okay.
So they're taking the calls there. They're answering the chats there, the text messages there. And, you know, it's working out really well. We've adapted like most of the country in the world has to what's going on today. And that's a good thing. And it's also a good thing that, you know, people are very interested in still having some kind of a Thanksgiving this year. You know, we did some surveying in the off season and we came up with nearly 90% of people say they still want to make some kind of Thanksgiving meal happen. So that's what we're here is to help people celebrate the good. You know, everybody needs some good news in their lives.
Right.
And to celebrate the good, just to do it safely.
Yeah. Now, you know, in years past, we would always have questions about people with 20-pound plus birds, and you know, how do I defrost it? How do I cook it? How do I do this? How do I do that? I suspect that most of the gatherings are going to be smaller this year. So what, I mean, obviously, you know, if you're going to get a whole turkey, a smaller one, but are there other alternatives as well?
Well, there are. You know, Butterball has a range of products, Dean, that are across the board as far as turkey. You know, you don't have to get a whole turkey to celebrate Thanksgiving. We do make smaller turkeys, or produce smaller turkeys, I should say, from about 10 pounds up. So, you know, you can do that. When you're figuring up how much turkey to have, you should account for about, or allow for about 2 pounds per person. Now, you know, they're not going to sit down and eat 2 pounds of turkey. Although you might want to, it's pretty good. But, you know, 2 pounds per person, so when you're figuring out how much to buy. But if you don't want to get that turkey, we have a range of products. You can buy a turkey breast, which is lighter, of course, and less yield on that. You can also buy, we have boneless turkey roasts, which are great, and those are around the 3 pound size.
Yeah, I've had
those. So that's
those.
A nice size.
I've had those. I've had those, the boneless turkey roasts. So easy to make, so easy to slice. Just a really nice alternative for you know, small get-togethers. Is the cooking process different for turkey breast as opposed to a turkey, other than accounting for its size?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit different, you know, because of course with turkey, the one thing that is the constant is the oven temperature. You know, the Butterball recommended method is a 325 degree oven, and that stays constant across the board, whether it's a turkey, a whole turkey, or a turkey breast, or even the turkey roast. So, you know, that's one thing that's constant. Then it's going to depend on the size of the, you know, of the item that you're cooking, of course. Now, the turkey roasts at 3 pounds, they're going to take about 1¾ to 2 hours to cook in the oven. So, you know, considerably less time. And, you know, you brought up a couple of good points. They're easy to slice. They're in a little netting that holds it together. And they come with a gravy packet. And so they're just, it's a really nice product.
Couldn't
be easier.
You don't
want to go ahead and go with that large turkey.
Could not be easier. Just a couple of quick things. What's the defrost rule? Somebody buys a bird this weekend. And it's, you know, rock solid. How much time do you need to allow for safe defrosting?
Thawing a turkey is our number one question that we've gotten on the talk line for 39 years. This is our 39th year of operation. And it is number one. And we recommend thawing the turkey in the refrigerator, which is going to take some time, of course. So what we say, we designated the Thursday before Thanksgiving, which this year will be this coming Thursday, the 19th of November, as National Thaw Day. So if you're picking up your turkey this weekend and you have room in your freezer, put it into your freezer until Thursday, and then you can take it out and put it into your refrigerator to thaw.
Okay.
That's the easiest way to thaw a turkey, and it's going to take, depending on the size of the turkey, it could take a matter of 3 to 4 days to up to 5 to 6 days if you're still going with that larger turkey.
But either way, it'll still be safe because it's in the fridge, but allow yourself that week, and you'll have plenty of wiggle room. I want to get right to some questions because we have a shorter amount of time this week. So if you do have questions for Bill, 312-981-7200, and of course, we'll tell you how you can get a hold of the Butterball Turkey Talk line on the phone or online, et cetera. Nick was on the line waiting for you, Bill. Nick, you're on WGN. Hello.
Okay, great. Thank you, Nick. And I'm Nick. Thanks, Bill and Dean. This year we're going to do something a little different. We're just going to roast some turkey parts, legs and wings only.
Huh.
We're only going to have two people, my wife and I. Are not going to have the traditional 12 that come over. So any advice on the length that we should be roasting those two items?
That's a great question, and the parts are always good to roast, Nick. There, I particularly like the thighs. I like to do thighs because they're pretty meaty. Legs are great, even wings are good. And you know what we recommend again is a 325 degree temperature. You want to take those items and brush them with a little bit of vegetable oil, season them with some salt and pepper, and put them on a sheet tray or a cookie sheet with a flat rack so that there's an air circulation underneath them. And it's going to take anywhere, depending on the size, you know, the wings are going to get done a little bit quicker, but it's going to take anywhere from about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour and a half. So again, one thing we like to drill home with anything when you're cooking turkey is to always check the temperature of it before you take it out of the oven the last time. And with those items, you want to, if you're doing something like a thigh, that needs to be cooked to about 180 degrees, legs as well. So they're going to be cooked to a little bit higher. If you're cooking a whole turkey, the breast area needs to be cooked to 170. But just make sure you have a reliable meat thermometer and go ahead and, you know, check those temperatures as you're going along. But it's going to be somewhere in that range because those parts are going to be, it's like doing a parts of chicken, you know, they're going to cook at different rates.
Yeah. Will those continue to cook once he takes them out of the oven? Will it continue to cook while he lets it rest on, you know, on top of the stove? In other words, should he take it out at 170 or 175, figuring that it's going to continue to cook, or be on the safe side?
Be on the safe side, we recommend. You know, when you're dealing with those small items, a small item will have a degree of what they call carryover cooking. So, you know, they will rise in temperature a couple of degrees, but it really won't matter that much. The nice thing about the items that are the items like the thighs and the legs, it's dark meat. So that meat is naturally a more moist meat, so it's not going to dry out. So if it goes over the 180 degrees even a little bit, it's not going to dry out and be tough.
Yeah, it's a little more forgiving than, a turkey breast, for example, that's all white meat and can tend to dry out faster. I presume that's why you're cooking the turkey breasts at a lower internal temperature. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right. You know, and that's the thing. You know, we tell customers when they call up why it's so important to have that meat thermometer, because, you know, it's really twofold. You know, and you're right, the breast 170 degrees, because the breast naturally is very lean. So if it doesn't have a lot of fat in that breast, it's going to dry out easily, much like a chicken breast can dry out. So you want to cook it to 170 degrees, but, you know, it's so important for food safety, but again, quality too. You know, I think we've all been in situations where, you know, through the years growing up, I can remember growing up and you'd go to somebody's house for Thanksgiving and the turkey was a little dry. You know, well, it was probably cooked to 180 or 185 degrees, which will definitely dry it out. So that meat thermometer is, if you don't have one already, it is well worth the investment.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to have a nice container of gravy handy, just in case you run into a problem.
Exactly.
Nick, thank you. Thanks for the call. Pam, this was sort of the question that you were going to ask about keeping the breast from drying out, right?
Right. ours is going to be a bone-in turkey breast. And I know white meat's always dry, and I just don't know what to do with it in the oven.
What can you tell her, Bill?
Sure. The bone-in turkey breast, you know, depending on the size of the breast, the bone-in turkey breast is going to cook at a 325-degree temperature as well. But the best thing you can do to make sure that it doesn't dry out, and if you're using a butterball turkey breast, it will not dry out if you don't cook it above that 170 degrees. So the key thing is to watch the temperature on it. Now, again, you can use just a regular meat thermometer. You want it in the oven for 325 degrees, and you want to prop it up on a rack so you get some air circulation, you know, underneath it, so the heat is distributed evenly. And they, again, depending on how much it weighs, but if you go to butterball.com, they will have charts there that will tell you exactly how much for that breast, how long to cook it for, depending on the weight when you have it. And also you can call Butterball, 1-800-BUTTERBALL, and talk to one of our representatives, our turkey experts there.
Hey, Bill,
they can also give you that information.
Bill, what about Pam brining her turkey breast first? Doesn't that add a lot of, it's simple to do, but doesn't that add a lot of moisture that might otherwise not be there?
Yeah, it does. You know, and brining has been popular. You know, two things that have really been popular over the last several years have been brining and deep frying. And brining does add moisture. And what you want to do is make sure that you don't, when you're brining it, and I think it's a good way to go with the turkey breast, just make sure that you don't over brine it. So when you're putting together the brine, and again, there's a million recipes on the internet for different brines to use, make sure that, you know, you mix it up well. And a couple of tips on that: if the brine requires cooking to dissolve the salt, because salt is the main component in the brine. If it involves cooking, make sure that you cool it off completely, the brine, before you go ahead and brine that turkey breast, because, of course, you don't want a warm liquid with a cold turkey breast. But the rule of thumb on that is 1 hour of brining for every pound. So if you have a 5-pound turkey breast, you don't want to brine it for more than 5 hours, because then you're going to get something that's going to be overly salty. Yeah. It might be moist, but it's going to be probably saltier than you'd like.
Yeah, I saw a recipe this week for a buttermilk brine that it sounds interesting, and it sounds like it could be really tasty. Does that mean anything to you, Bill?
I haven't seen that recipe. I'd be interested to take a look at that. I'll have to Google that.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with the buttermilk brine, but it sounds like it might. And you're right. I think it could be very interesting.
Yeah, it was in the New York Times this week. Something to take a look at. Pam, I hope that helps, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Pam.
Guys,
it'll just be my husband and myself. My son and his wife won't be coming over.
Yeah, that's everyone's doing small gatherings this year. So it's just this 1 year. We want to stay healthy, right? We don't want anyone to get sick. So for this 1 year, it'll be something to talk about in years to come. Remember that year that none of us could get together? Pam, thanks for the call, Pam. I appreciate it. And Bill, give me all the info on people want to get information directly. It's butterball.com, right?
Right, butterball.com, which is our website. And I've got to throw in this little blurb about the butterball.com website. It's been revamped this year, and we've got a lot of new recipes on the butterball.com website. There's how-to videos. You can also go to the website and email us through that website. If you go down to the bottom of the first page, and you'll see information on how to email us or live chat us through the website.
Sounds good.
So there's a great way to get a hold of us the website, and of course, calling us as well.
Right, and we're going to do this again here next Sunday at the same time. I'm going to have some tips on WGN-TV morning news this week. Butterball Turkey Talk Line pal, Bill Nolan, thank you, and have a great Sunday today.